As he said, we are going to be looking at Esther chapter 3, or on the end of chapter 2, this evening. I'd never preached a sermon, let alone a series, on the book of Esther until a couple of weeks ago, and I'm beginning to realise why. It is simply not a normal biblical book. It's a difficult book to get an entrance into. It's a book we've seen where there's no mention of God. He doesn't speak. He doesn't act in obvious godlike ways in the book, thundering from heaven. There aren't fingers that gate crash kings' parties and write on the walls. Seas are not split. Plagues are not sent. Even the hero and the heroine are complex characters. Possibly compromised characters. We're not shown them doing any religious stuff. They don't say, well, let's go and find out what God has to say in the Bible. They don't say, let's pray about this. They possibly did, but we're not given that information at all. It's been deliberately withheld from us. And the writer wants to take you into a world that probably looks a lot more like your own world than you realise. It's a world where powerful men have stood in the place of God and are now issuing decrees as if they are God, with no respect to God. We'll overturn everything. We'll do this. Sounds like your world. It's a world where God seems to be silent, where God almost seems to be absent, where everything seems to be stacked against the people of God. There are people who don't have an earthly king. There are people who don't have their own land. They're in exile. They don't have a city. They don't have a temple. They don't have an army. And yet they find themselves in the middle of a great battle. That sounds like our world and the church. And yet, having read it for the first time, looking for God and not finding him, you read the book of Esther for the second time, knowing where it's all going, and you find God everywhere, acting in every verse. And you realise that he doesn't need always to tear down Jericho's walls or to send an angel to decimate Sennacherib's army. He's also the God who is very happily working through the tiny providences of this life. And he's even working through the actions, good, sometimes neutral, sometimes evil, of people here on earth. God is never absent. And that's where this 5th century BC book of Esther is such a comfort and a calming influence to us as Christians in the 21st century chaos that we live in. He's present. He's working in everything that we're seeing going on. Do you believe that? Because if you don't believe that, we ought to shut our Bibles and go home. It's not easy to see, is it? But we have to hold on to that by faith. So in chapter 1, we've been taken to the court of the Persian Empire in its heyday, in its absolute glory days. The king, Ahasuerus, we know him as from history as Xerxes, is there in all of his pomp and his power. And he's hosting this vast exhibition of all of his wealth for the governors and the military leaders of 127 regions that he reigns over, stretching from India down into Ethiopia. And it's a council of war. What Xerxes is doing is he is readying his empire for the invasion of Europe with the goal of sacking Athens, which he's promised that he's going to do. And he's demanding, buying the loyalty of all of these disparate armies that come together under his empire. And yet the biblical narrative doesn't even mention the Battle of Thermopylae that the historians are all so interested in, that takes place a couple of years later. And that would have dominated the news at that time, this tension between Persia and Europe. But that's a subservient importance to God's story. He's got something much more important to bring into focus as he goes through this book. And so our focus as we come to the end of chapter one is on a battle much closer to home between a drunken, boastful, oafish king and his beautiful, offended queen, Vashti. Vashti, who stands him up and then gets deselected as being queen, thus clearing the way for Esther in chapter 2, a Jewess, to become queen of Persia for a reason that we don't yet know as we're going through the book. And then we saw last time that Esther herself is an enigma. Is she this pure heroine that we learnt about in Sunday school those years ago? Or is she actually a cunning compromiser, playing the system to get to the top? Or is she probably something in between those two positions? A girl trying to find her identity in a pagan world, in a confusing world, in the midst of events that she seems to have little control over. Yes, she's a failure if you judge her by the law, but then which of us wouldn't be? She's hidden her Jewish identity. She's compromised the food laws and the Sabbath laws of the old Torah. She's got into the bed of a man she's not married to. She's ended up as the wife of a godless Gentile. But whilst many commentators foolishly write her off as a compromiser, God hadn't written her off. And he takes her by the hand. And when she does have to reconcile who she actually is she Hadassah, the Jewess, or Esther, Queen of Persia? She's able to bring them together and identify with the people of God. But so much of the information that I'm looking for in this book, that I normally find in the Bible, is hidden from us. If you're like me, you're interested in not just what people do, but why they do it. I want to know their motives. And I'm going to have the same problem this evening with Mordecai. I want to know why he didn't bow down. Was it for good reasons? And then, like most of the sermons that I've read on Esther chapter 3, I could preach a sermon on the importance of not bowing down to the idols of this world. Like Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego, you've got to remain standing, even though you end up risking your own life. And what all those sermons that I've read miss out is that he didn't just risk his own life through this act. He risked the life of all of his people through this act. We're not told whether it's for good reasons. It could have been for negative reasons. It might have been because of wounded pride that Haman had got the position that he wanted. And as I'm getting frustrated with what God hasn't told us, which he easily could have done, we can easily miss what God does tell us, which are genealogies of Haman and Mordecai, and very exact dates in chapter 3. And he's saying, you're going to have to do some work here, Netley, on your first 6 o'clock service on a Sunday evening. You're going to have to dig deep into the text, and you're going to have to find out, are there clues to a story within a story here? A story of how God works through his providences and the actions of men and women, sometimes flawed, to bring about his grand designs. And that's the story of the book of Esther. And grasping it shouldn't lead us to become careless or fatalistic. The fact that your God, as he does in Esther, that he does always, he wins, and he always has won, and he's already won, should be the greatest encouragement to you and I to be faithful in any situation that we find ourselves in with the light that God has given to us. Not carelessness, but confidence, even in a world of disappointments, frustrations, injustice, and hostility. Esther's telling you God's still in control. He's still on the throne, even when it doesn't look like it. So let's come to this part of the book. Firstly, we're reminded that we live in a world that's often not fair. And it isn't fair, is it? It's not fair what happens in chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3. At the end of chapter 2, Mordecai has overheard Bigthan and Teresh having their whispered conversation somewhere in a corner about how they're going to do Ahasuerus in. And having overheard it, he's then reported this plot against the king to Esther, who has told the king in Mordecai's name. And he's saved the king's life. And it's all been written down in the book of Chronicles in the presence of the king. Mordecai can expect at least a thank you card, can't he? A box of chocolates? Well, I think he was expecting a promotion. And the equivalent of a knighthood. He's done a great deed, but the king promptly forgets to do anything to honour Mordecai. And as chapter 3 begins, not as we'd expected with the rise of Mordecai, but instead with the rise of Haman. And Haman isn't even a decent human being. His name means wrath. And he certainly lives up to his name. He is a horrible, corrupt, duplicitous, conniving, vindictive, proud man, and he becomes prime minister. He demands respect. He doesn't earn it. John, stop laughing. I know what he was thinking. He's a person who has to get laws passed in order to get people to bow down to him. He uses power like that. And we read this and we think, but this is wrong. It's not fair. Why has the good man been trampled on and the evil man honoured? Well, that's not just something that comes out of the book of Esther. That comes out of the Bible again and again. It's a complaint of the Psalms so often. Why have the godless triumphed and you've forgotten about the godly Lord? It's the complaint of the prophets. We see it in our own world, the one who rises to the top in politics or in business or in their profession. They're often not the most deserving. Sometimes they are, but often they're not. Or the most qualified, but they can be the most ruthless, the most driven. The ones who are most self-promoting. And I just wonder, did Mordecai struggle with what had happened? And was that partly behind this reason to refuse to bow down to Haman? His cause had been overlooked. And Haman was hoovering up all of the titles and the honour. There was quite possibly real disappointment in Mordecai's life. That made me think, how do you deal with disappointment, with setback, with injustice, when you and I are not given what we feel we should have been given, when things haven't gone as we'd wanted them to go? Well, doesn't the book of Esther help us a little bit here? Doesn't it say, look, you can relax in the sovereignty of God, and your plans, your expectations might have been this, but they weren't as good as God's plans for you. Because he's promised, and again, we can shut our Bibles if this is not true, that he has plans for you which are for good, not to harm you, but to bless you. And something happens in my life and I'm up in arms against God saying, but you haven't blessed me, you've harmed me. I come back to see what's happening just in a little incident like this. And I'm reminded of God's, we love that quote here, God's mysterious historical slowness, which is never too late. His timing in our lives, which is absolutely impeccable. Because think about it, if Mordecai had been honoured at the end of chapter 2, then he wouldn't have been honoured after a king's sleepless night later on the eve of the Holocaust against his people. And we read it through the first time and we think, God, you've missed the opportunity. We read it through the second time and we think, God, you were all over this. You're Your works are perfect, and all your ways are just. And he can teach us things through the disappointments that we would never have learned if we'd been in the heights. Now, we learn far more, I think, in the valleys, don't we, than on the mountaintops. I was thinking of Joseph. You know, he's good, he's faithful, he does the right thing, and he ends up in prison. And then he does a good thing, and he interprets someone's dream for them, and they promptly forget about him. And we're thinking, the first time we read it, God, you've got this all wrong. But the second time we read it, we see, if all that hadn't happened, if Joseph had been remembered and released, he would have toddled off back to Canaan and to his dad, and he wouldn't have been there to interpret the dreams of Pharaoh and to save Egypt and to save the world. God has a plan for every one of our lives. And we can rest in the perfection of that plan. And we can also ultimately rest in the fact that he is a God of justice, and all wrongs will be put right. And everything which the world has overlooked, he hasn't overlooked. And more than being a God of justice, he's also a God of grace. And those who have trusted him, who have given their lives to him, are the people who at the end of time will hear those words from Matthew 25:34, "Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from before the foundation of the world." And then he goes on to bring out the things that everybody had overlooked and even we'd forgotten. The little things. And he says, "I so treasured this. It was so important to me. Let me honour you for your love and your commitment to me." My dad used to tell me when I was grumbling about how things had not gone right in my life and complaining, he'd say, "Son, God is no man's debtor." And it's true. And he'd remind me of the words of George Whitefield, who was just hammered by the Christians of his day for the things that he was doing. And all of his friends were saying, "Come on, George, stand up and fight for yourself. Write an essay against them and get it published. Destroy them because you could do it." And George said, "I'm not bothered with that. The day will declare it. Let me just get on with following Jesus, please." And that's a lovely attitude to be able to have in life. But secondly, we're introduced to a world that is so hostile to the people of God. A world through which a battle is constantly raging. At times it breaks out in obvious ways, as here when Mordecai's refusal to bow down to Haman is met in a way which is out of all proportion to what anyone could have expected. It's met with fury, well, you'd expect that from him, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they'd made known to him that Haman, the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. And we read that and we think that escalated quickly. That came out of nowhere. Or did it? This is just a battle within a bigger war. And the writer has dropped little clues into the story for you to pull out. Look at the way that Mordecai and Haman have both been introduced to us. Go back to chapter 2, verse 5 for Mordecai. "Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite." Now, that is a very shortened version of his genealogy. But who came between Shimei, the Benjamite, who cursed David, and Kish? Who was Kish's son? Saul. King Saul. And then when Haman is introduced to us, he's introduced in chapter 3, verse 1, as Haman the Agagite, the son of Hamadatha. So he belongs to the family of a man called Agag. Now, when did Agag and Saul meet? Who was Agag? Well, Agag was the king of the Amalekites, whom God told Saul that he was to fight against and to destroy. And he didn't do it. He spared the best of the property, and he spared Agag's life. And God said there's going to be constant friction and warfare between Agag's family and your family, Saul. And now, why had God wanted judgment brought on the Amalekites? That doesn't seem a very nice thing to do. Well, at the time of the Exodus, when the people were coming to the promised land and approaching it, Amalek, the Amalekites, became the first people to try to destroy the infant nation of Israel. They were the covenant-carrying people, the people who had the promise given to their forefather, Abraham, that out of their family would come one who would save the whole earth. And before they'd even got into their land, Amalek had come out and tried to absolutely destroy them. We go back another couple of generations to this people before they're a nation. There are peoples in Egypt, and they're still carrying the covenant forward of salvation for this world. And Egypt unleashed this Holocaust on Israel and tried to wipe out all of their children and so wipe out their nation. And then that takes us back another few steps, doesn't it? Where did this covenant of salvation begin? Well, it goes back to Genesis chapter 3, where God had said, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring, plural, and her offspring, plural, and he, singular, shall crush your head, and you shall crush his heel. God is saying right from the beginning there are going to be two peoples in this world. There's going to be my people, and then Satan, there's going to be your family, and there's going to be conflict between these people. And this is simply another phase in the battle where Satan sees an opportunity to destroy the covenant people of God and thus the covenant. No wonder God isn't fixated in the book of Esther on the Battle of Thermopylae. He's got far more important things to be concerned about here. The salvation of the world, the kingdom of God. It's a battle, isn't it, that's rumbled on throughout history. It keeps appearing. We were looking at Daniel. We came across that strange man, Antiochus Epiphanes, a few centuries later, who just tries to destroy Jerusalem and Israel for no apparent reason. It's the same battle. After the New Testament church is set up and begins to grow, it's not very long before religious powers and political powers combine and vent their fury on the church. It goes on throughout the ages, through the Roman Empire. It goes on after that, cut to the time of the Reformation, and it looks as though the world has won. The church's light has been extinguished, suffocated under a cloak of superstition, destroyed through persecution. Darkness covers Europe. And yet God did something. You can read it on the Reformer's Wall in Geneva, post tenebras lux, after darkness, light. Because this people, this church, they can't be destroyed. But the opposition comes back. You see it in Revelation. Satan enraged, hurling himself against the church. I was just struck by verse 8, because even the most apparently the most liberal societies seem to echo Haman's words. Look at verse 8. There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among all the peoples, in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people. They don't keep the king's laws, so that it's not in the king's profit to tolerate them. That sounds like Christians living in a society in the West somewhere. They're different. They don't bow down to the great project to rewrite all of God's laws now in different ways as man's laws. They don't bow down to the law to overturn the sanctity of life. These are evil, pro-life people. We need to ban them from YouTube, which is what's happened, and from Facebook. They can't spout their evil about saving unborn children in public. Deplatform them. Don't allow them to speak. They don't accept our views on morality or gender or marriage. They have a loyalty to another king. Well, that sounds like the church. And as in Esther's day, it wasn't easy being part of the people of God. And so in our day, there's pressure and opposition. And those who oppose, and it's a lot worse in most other places in the world, but those who oppose, they seem to have all of the power and the influence. They write the laws. They set the curriculum. They can dictate the news. And all Esther's got, it just doesn't seem fair, does it? All Esther's got is God. That's all we've got. It isn't fair, is it? It was never in doubt. And I'll close with this. We live in a world where God reigns absolutely, supremely. Get a marvellous bit now when Haman decides to cast lots to determine the day on which he's going to execute this master plan. It's the first time in the book when destiny comes into it, when a man feels that he's not quite in control of things, and he doesn't just like say, right, we're going to do it this day. He wants to consult his gods when there aren't any. But we're reminded from the book of Proverbs, aren't we? The lot is cast into the lap, but it's every decision is from the Lord. And having done various procedures with the Purim, the lot, the day comes to nearly a year away before he can get it all to pass. But it's all set, and the law that is passed, the edict is passed a year or so before, on the 13th day of the first month, and couriers all over the kingdom speedily rush this. What was the significance of the 13th day of the first month? It was the eve of Passover. So as these couriers rushed these written transcripts of the new law to destroy all Israel on this later day, it would have been Passover itself. What a blow to the people of God getting ready to celebrate the greatest deliverance of their past and then being confronted with this. A day of joy would have been turned into a day of mourning and despair. And the king and Haman, they sit down to drink. And the city is in confusion. And what we're not told, but we know it's happening, is that the Lord just keeps on working relentlessly, irresistibly, silently. And the day that Haman had sealed to be the day of Israel's destruction, chapter 9, verse 21, becomes the day of his own destruction. And a day that's been turned for them from sorrow into gladness, from mourning into a holiday. And you read it, you think, oh God, you were so in control. Why did we ever doubt you? But I can't think of that without being transported to another eve of Passover, about 500 and something years later. A time that Jesus called the hour of the power of darkness. When the light of the world was extinguished in death. when the Son of God had been utterly rejected by men, when he'd been crucified, killed, and the hope of the covenant seemed to be shattered. And the mourning amongst the few followers that there were, and the sorrow was inconsolable. This was the one time in history it appeared when God had not stepped in to save the one who was righteous. Until three women went to a tomb and found it empty. And an angel asked them that wonderful question, "Why are you looking for the living amongst the dead? He's risen. He's not here." And we see that God was working when he seemed to be most invisible. Yes, Jesus, his heel had been crushed in that event, just as God had said right from the beginning. But in doing that, Satan's head had been crushed. He was cast down. He was silenced. Sin was paid for. And we can sing, "Death is dead. Christ has won. He is risen." And sorrow was turned into gladness, and mourning into rejoicing. And all these years later, we were thinking about it this morning, he's still alive. He hasn't left heaven. He hasn't abdicated the throne. He hasn't faced a vote of no confidence in heaven. There'll never be one. Heaven has every confidence in him. And he's still reigning today. And he's going to reign for your good, because he loves you so much. And for the glory of God, and until he's put all of his enemies under his feet. Even when it looked like he wasn't there, he was everywhere. As I said at the beginning, doesn't that bring comfort and confidence for us today? We can't read the providences of today as we're going through them. Not easily, anyway. Any more than Esther and Mordecai could have read the providences of God as they were living through the opening chapters of the book. But we know he knows what he's doing. And we know that when we read the world's history from the perspective of heaven, we'll say, he was all over this. Why didn't I trust him more? He was brilliant. What skill. He did all things well. You're going to say that. I promise you. I'm going to remind you in heaven when we just review 2019 and the decades of our lives. We're just going to say, look at God. Why didn't we trust him? But at the moment, like Esther and like Mordecai, we have to hold on by faith. We have to see by faith. Though we can't understand, we know he does. And so we can sleep comfortably tonight. And we can meet next week with confidence and a peace that surpasses all understanding. Because Jesus still reigns. And he always wins. Esther tells you that. The whole Bible tells you that. Your life tells you that. And eternity will tell you that. That's enough from me. Amen.